long ago, in a time of darkness and tyranny, there was an evil king who threatened the land and its people. The only hope was an incredible alliance between a man of honor and a creature of legend.
Dragonheart is a 1996 fantasy film directed by Rob Cohen, starring Dennis Quaid, David Thewlis, Dina Meyer, and starring the voice of the incomparable Sean Connery. Jim, the connections to Game of Thrones here, obvious.
Dragons.
It's right there in the title.
Yeah.
You can't.
Hearts. Right?
Dragons and
people
hearts.
In Game of Thrones have hearts.
Yeah, and Daenerys ate a whole one in his first season one.
So, horse hearts.
Unlike Reign of Fire, that likes to bury its Game of Thrones connection under the lead, it wears it front and center. What? Talk about your history of Dragonheart. What do you think of it, et cetera, et cetera.
I can't remember ever actually having seen this movie, but
you didn't see this
I have.
In the theater?
No. Definitely not in the theater.
Wow. Okay.
If I have seen it, it's on TV, but I almost feel like this is one of those sort of osmosis 90s movies for me. Like,
right.
I never caught all of it. I caught clips and my friends talked about it. And I just sort of feel like I have a shared experience of this movie, even though I've never seen it.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of where I came into this movie from. And I watched it the first time for the live watch. And I thought, man, this is an awful movie. Mm-hmm. I really hate this movie. And then on my second watch, I'm thinking, no, I don't hate this movie. And it's not an awful movie. It's kind of just like a 90s mid-budget movie.
Yeah, and you know? At some points, some of it pretty good, but at some points, the quality just inexplicably falls through the floor.
Yeah, and it's sort of miscast, and the tone doesn't quite hit right, but that's kind of 90s mid-budget movies in a nutshell, isn't
right.
it?
Yeah.
Like, unless you were doing really stellar work, which it's funny because they Amazon wanted us to roll directly from that into Jurassic Park, which is a stellar 90s movie.
Yeah, yeah.
Unless you're doing those kind of big-budget films with amazing directors, then this is kind of what you get. And I don't think it's awful. I think it's mediocre.
Yeah, and I'm kind of the same opinion. It's a fun kind of 90s movie, and it has a lot of those fun, like, this has a lot in its DNA in common with, like, Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves, and some of the other, you know, medieval misadventures of the late 80s and 90s. But I started reading more about the making of this film, and I started feeling bad because I feel like the person who wrote this, this Charles Pogue character, really had this idea of making like a modern day classic fairy tale in the vein of like a Princess Bride, something that all ages could enjoy. Unironically, it would teach like some positive morals, and it would actually have like a strong narrative arc for the hero to go through. And they hired this Rob Cohen guy to direct it, and he just went Guy Ferrari on some of the aspects of this project. And they, like you said, miscasting, the guy that they wanted to attach this project was Liam Neeson.
Yeah.
And I think about what, and nothing against Dennis Quaid, because I like Dennis Quaid as an actor.
Mm-hmm.
But as soon as I heard that, I'm like, holy shit, the character of Bowen would be twice as good just putting Liam Neeson in there, because he's not struggling with an accent. He's not struggling with this weird, gruff Batman voice. He's just believably this knight of integrity and honor. And I just feel like when I see things like that, and we'll talk about this later in the podcast, where I see things where, you know, it's not like a massive misstep, although there are one or two scenes like that. But you think of like it was a tweak here and there, and this could have been like a classic movie, and it wasn't. So if you're not familiar, if you're like Jim and you just kind of are vaguely aware of Dragonheart, this movie came out in 1996, and it's about a knight who is one of the last to hold the old Arthurian code of chivalry and honor. And he's trying to instill this into a young boy prince, a young Prince Joffrey type.
And remember the old code. Then you'll be a greater king than your father.
Because his father's a real shit. And the son is wounded in this peasant battle that his father is fighting, And Bowen the Knight and his mother, the Queen, who has great respect for the ancient ways and the weird quasi-dragon religion they have in this universe, take the boy to be saved by dragon magic. The dragon infuses half of his dragon heart with the humans in some magical process that sustains the boy's life. But then the boy turns into a real shitter, and he doubles down on all of his father's policies, engages in some slavery, some torture, some mayhem, attempted rape, and those are the stakes. Those are the stakes, and who's going to win? Is it going to be the knight and his old code backed by dragon magic and the last noble living dragon on Earth, or is it going to be the shitter king? Spoiler alert, in real life, the shitter king's won. We have no more dragons. We have no more men of honor. We're living in these modern times where those concepts are laughable and silly. So we know how it ended, but this is a reimagining. Like, if we still had cool dragons that sounded like Sean Connery. Okay, deep dive incoming.
All right, let's start with the themes of this film, because I think like the central one is this idea of, like you said, the old code versus essentially people without honor.
Social Darwinism.
Yeah, they're saying all modern people have no honor. There's nothing good left in this world.
Yeah.
Everything that was good ever, that ever existed, came from our past.
Mm-hmm.
And we have no hope.
Mm-hmm.
And somehow this old ancient being, this dragon, is going to give us hope back.
Right.
I reject, on the face of it, this entire assertion.
Sure.
That anything was ever better in the past.
Right.
Nothing has ever been better than it is right now, and
categorically,
nothing will
certainly not
ever be better than it is in the future.
Uh-huh.
So, like, the idea that somehow these noble men existed and weren't playing on their own terms,
uh-huh,
is, in my mind, completely ridiculous. Mm. And the only reason that people think that is because they were so fucking busy surviving at the time, they didn't have time to deal with the injustices and the harsh cruelties of the societies that existed then to actually give enough of a fuck to have time to do anything about it.
Well, especially because, like, I do think there's moments in time where things are measurably worse, like mid-40s Germany, bad place.
Uh-huh.
But yeah, like when you look at like generational time spans, and that's what this movie is proclaiming, that there was this period of time where it's just gradually centuries long descent into barbarism and bullshit.
Yeah.
When, you know, like that's the other thing, is also King Arthur's not real history. We could tear apart this film's premise, but so does it work on a fairy tale logic, or? It seems like
I think so. If you ignore, you know, the more disturbing parts of this film's message,
okay,
or the false parts of it,
you just want to argue for general appreciation for modernity,
sure,
which I wholeheartedly support.
I think it holds together. On first watch, I was very confused because we were cracking jokes over it, but second watch, I didn't have so much of a problem with it, and I think the shame of it is, like you mentioned, this movie got bastardized in the creation process, and whatever, you know, cohesive storyline and thematic through lines that the original writer had developed in that script, I feel got minimized in favor of doing things that were crowd pleasers. And it's a real damn shame, because I think, like, a good portion of this movie holds up, and it's the silly stuff that's interjected by this new directive force that kind of brings the whole movie down.
Yeah, and I feel like the soundtrack is almost like a guide to that. I think this has got, when the movie gives a shit, a pretty damn fine soundtrack.
Mm-hmm.
Very James Hornerian, Lord of the Rings, stirring, epic, you know, lots of horns and rolling drums and whatnot, and then you get into some parts where the movie is trying to be like provide comic relief, and it turns into this jaunty heist, like I don't know, children's television show music.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like almost like you can tell that it feels like that this stuff was forced on it by an outside, like this is parts of some other person's vision intruding on the thing, and the movie itself resents it.
Yeah.
Like, the performances aren't as good. The music isn't as good. The dialogue and writing and all that stuff. Anytime the movie tries to go into silly gear, it's not great. And watching like Jason Isaacs trying to be silly early on in his career, if you don't recognize his name, Jason Isaacs is the latest captain of the Star Trek Discovery from season one, I guess. And he also is notably the patriarch of the Malfoy family in Harry Potter.
Yeah, I struggled to come up with what I had seen him in while we were watching
this. He's Bloody Bannon in The Patriot, too, the old Mel Gibson.
Yeah, no, he's a lot. Yeah. I've seen him in a lot of movies.
But he's always this like kind of severe, imperious character. Yeah. And here he's kind of a buffoon. And boy, he does not wear that skin well.
A road tax, King Arnold. A road tax.
I mean, they are your roads after all. People really ought to pay for the privilege of using them. And those that can't pay, of course, will have to work it off.
Ingenious, Felton. Only you can keep such a good brain under such a bad hat.
But no, I forget where I was even going with
well, one of the prime examples of this movie being...
Oh, the tone problems.
Being completely screwed up. So yeah, there's a lot of stuff with the tone. I was going to kind of take it to... The general vibe that they were going for in the original script was kind of one that was more serious, and one that found Bowen, over the course of his scams with this dragon, feeling more and more guilty about what he's doing, and how the new creative crew that took this over completely undermined that by making some small changes that were pointed out to them as being crucially stupid changes that make zero sense in context. And this guy simply didn't care.
Yeah.
Well, the prime example of that being this river town, river village, whatever you want to call it, with
swamp
all
town.
Of these
I think
pigs.
River is generous. It's river a swamp
is
town.
Very generous. But it has all these pigs walking around in it, right? Yeah. And when I watch this for the first time, I'm thinking, okay, when they do this turn and they see this dragon down and they're like, meat, meat.
Meat. Meat. Meat. Meat. Meat.
I'm thinking this is not the first time these people have tasted meat. There is meat all around
them.
Yeah,
there are rotund pigs.
Literally
there's
10
pigs for every
meat.
One person. Yeah. And maybe they're the king's pigs, but if you're starving, if you're choosing between cannibalism, which is where
that's where they go by the end of this scene.
Right.
And so I'm thinking, is this really your idea of meat here? Doesn't make any sense. And apparently these pigs weren't originally in the script. They weren't meant to be there. And when they were put into the film, this Pope guy says, look, this doesn't fucking make any sense.
Right.
These people are yelling about meat. They're starving. They're turning to cannibalism at the end of this scene.
Right.
And they have readily available meat all around them. What are we doing here?
And the
guy just said, nah, fuck it. I don't care.
And they're barely making the point. Like there's a single throwaway line where Sean Connery's dragon, Draco, as he springs into flight, ponders.
When you squeeze the nobility, it's the peasants who feel the pinch.
Like, are you really making things harder for the shitty king or his people? And but like they were going to originally the script show you that as he works his way from village to village, these set pieces they
that's
get poorer and
be...
poorer, and the dragon is kind of like testing him, and Bowen is you find his, you know, conscious being pricked leading up to this big set piece at the starving village, and they completely undercut the themes they're trying to build there of like, you know, what does the old code mean? The old code means shitting on the brutal king at the expense of his people.
But they
completely lose that plot. Even the one point they're making as a gag that these people are going to be angry and want to eat the dragon slayer if they can't eat the dragon is undercut by the plethora of fucking pigs.
Right. Yeah, the movie becomes a mess when you start interjecting things that don't belong there.
Mm-mm.
And to your point, you know, about the tone, I felt like the tone was mismatched through most of the film. Anytime they go extremely silly, like... You know, this road toll thing. I don't even really know why the road toll thing needed to be there. Did we not know that the king is evil enough?
Right.
When he's enslaving people to build his towers? Do we really need the road tax as the final cherry on that cake?
Yeah.
Like, what the fuck?
And maybe you could even make that if you do it better and you have someone that actually is kind of that scheming. Like, I just don't buy it from this guy. I don't think Lucius Malfoy fits the... Like, oh, someone's going to throw a ridiculous suggestion as something that would be so far over the top that no one would ever seriously consider it, and that actually is his springboard for a fucking a solid idea. It's so fucking forced and weird and not done particularly well. The other thing I think is crucially miscast is David Thewlis, who I'm not going to hate on David Thewlis because like his work on the last season of Fargo is the most incredible act of villainy. And if he had brought that to the table in this performance, it would be a whole other deal. Because another thing is, I think this this Poe guy, I forget who he wanted to cast, but as somebody more like calculating and steady and like certainly ruthless and cruel and callous, but like more of a Darth Vader lawful evil than this guy who is a chaotic evil. And you get this gangly, oddly constructed, never in a million years would I buy him fighting Dennis Quaid. If you put Liam Neeson on the other end of that sword, it would be like the most egregious mismatch since like the climax of the Matrix, or not the Matrix movie, climax of Commando.
Right.
Bennett versus Matrix. Like, you know, you got Arnold Schwarzenegger, a literal Greek god, versus a guy like a 45-year-old softball coach. And this is the fight. This is the climax of the fucking film. So that's what you got. And this, like, David Thewlis is good. He's very young. He's not seasoned. He's gangly. He's got this manic, weird, chaos demon energy. And just it is a counterpoint to Dennis Quaid's The Old Code, but it just feels silly and goofy. And every single time they're in a sword fight, it's like they also. So this guy trained him. He should be kind of roughly equal. He's a lot younger, but like the first time they fight, Bowen just fucking hands this guy his ass until he gets some kind of emotional advantage over him. I don't know. That's just another problem with the casting in the film. Can we talk about some praiseworthy casting?
Okay, sure.
I thought Dina Meyer was really good, and I'm kind of surprised between this and Starship Troopers she didn't have more of an impactful career. I know she's done some interesting work, but if you look through IMDb, the last 15 years is just a big graveyard of yikes. Sci-fi original kind of level yikes.
That she's back to doing Starship Troopers sequels in 2017, which is a bad sign.
Yeah, and they're not even direct to video. They're not even direct to on demand. They're just direct to Pirate Bay.
I think they're just like direct to the director's film collection. Like,
yeah.
He's springing for a $600 camera.
He's never going to make it off his hard drive.
Yeah, 2 days of shooting, and then he's just like, yeah, that's my movie. That's just for me.
But no, she's like really plucky and winsome, and she's also got this kind of sturdiness to her. So she's when she starts having to swing around the swords and axes in the third act of the film, I never at any point thought, oh, this is kind of fucking ridiculous. I really liked what she's bringing to the table.
No, I'm with you, and I one of the most baffling things about this movie is what they do to her hair, because Dina Meyer has amazing hair.
Yes, she does,
and they cover it up with I don't know if it's meant to fit her better into the times, but it's basically a haystack that they put on her head and spray paint red.
Are you saying she's wearing a wig, Joe?
Oh yes,
when she wasn't wearing 5 pounds of shit.
Yeah, right. She's definitely wearing a wig, and it's one of those wigs where sometimes it looks almost passable, but then other scenes it's, my God, look at that wig.
Well, and I think that's the one maybe missed up in the original script, is that Poe wrote these characters, Bowen and Dina Meyer's character. I can't remember her name. The village.
Kara, the village
rebel. I was falling in love.
Yeah.
And I'm like, I didn't see any hints of that in the original script. And the way it was set up, where you've got this, you know, already old past his prime knight observing this battle where there's this girl, and maybe she's 13 and 12 years late. I just felt like, also, I don't know, it is a Sean Connery movie. I've seen him dick down a very young Catherine Zeta-Jones, and no one batted an eye. So maybe it's par for the course. I'm just thinking that, like, I felt like that would have been a misstep, because I don't think this isn't about Bowen's dick and his lust and his love life. Mm-hmm. It's about validating a cause that you've devoted your whole life in, and you've become so disillusioned that you thought nothing, you've lost yourself. You've lost yourself where revenge is more important than chivalry and honor. If other people are ground to dust because of it, anytime you've had that kind of thing, like a romance into it, feels meh. It feels like a distraction from that.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's, I mostly agree with that. I think like the movie is trying to get to a place, and I don't know that it succeeds, but mm-hmm. where she's falling in love with the man who he becomes at the end, the man who he was at the beginning. What I think is the double meaning of this film's title, which is Dragonheart. I think he has the heart of a dragon.
He has a metaphorical
sense,
heart of a
dragon. Yeah, like she's falling in love with his dragon heart, not his 45-year-old coach, softball coach body.
No, Grant.
And I don't want to take anything away from Dennis Quaid.
He's
in fine
a very
shape.
Attractive man.
Yeah, but he is much older than her, I assume.
The importance of the idea is people following him as like and choosing his way over the way of the land that's going, the way of greed and indifference and all that. Like him being like falling in love with that is fine, but like the physical, I don't know. Since it's not in the movie, and I feel like the movie doesn't miss a beat without it. Honestly, I thought Draco and Kara had better chemistry than Boa and Kara.
Dennis Quaid never sang to her.
That's true. That's true. Sean Connery, I actually think he did. He was just a massive fucking star in this era.
Yeah.
It seems weird because he's kind of disappeared off the face of the earth for the last 10 years. But he was a massive star. And this is a performance that's kind of begging to phone it in. And he doesn't seem like he's doing that. Like everything you needed him to do in this movie, he's funny. He's funny, as funny as the scene ever requires him to be. He's as commanding and threatening as he needs to be. He's as persuasive and smooth as he needs to be. It's really like he's even like someone got Sean Connery to stick like a fork in his mouth or something.
I was thinking, okay, so they had like a 20-something million dollar budget,
right?
Sean Connery must have been a big chunk of that.
Sure.
How much did they pay the intern that had to hold his tongue while he was talking in that scene?
Now, what is a talk like this?
What do you expect with all night rocking between my walls?
I mean,
this scene, oh my God. Okay, let's finish talking about Sean Connery, and then I want to talk about this fucking tongue ride that Dennis Quaid gets for half hour in this
movie. I'm pretty much done talking with Sean Connery. We can get to the tongue ride.
Let's talk about the tongue ride.
Because, like, this is one of the things of humor that I think kind of mostly works. Like, the idea of this knight being stuck in this dragon's mouth and Sean Connery rolling something.
It's so absurd, though.
Yeah.
It is so fucking absurd to see a dragon voiced by Sean Connery waggling its tongue up and down as it tries to negotiate with this fucking dragon slayer who's riding
his
tongue
right like a horse
wedge between his fucking legs.
Right,
man. I don't know, of the absurd scenes in this entire movie, this is the one that maybe works for me because it's the most absurd.
Well, and it works when you find out that Draco is not wanting to kill this knight. I think you understand that Draco knows exactly who this guy is the whole time, and he sees I need to get into dragon heaven. I really pushed all my chips in Dragon Heaven forward, and I bet on fucking medieval Hitler. So now I'm going to go straight to Dragon Hell unless I can rekindle this old code that the dragon, like, I don't know. There's a very, honestly, shit, how much of Skyrim was inspired by this fucking movie?
All of it.
The cover outfit of the fucking Dovahkiin or whatever the fuck his name is. Absolutely is a dragon hunter from this movie.
Oh, I've seen the helmets that they wear in Skyrim. It's on the cover of the fucking game.
Yeah, no, that's what I'm saying.
They're like one that dragon outfit shout away from having Skyrim in this movie.
Yeah, like if someone fussed Rodor'd instead of shooting a fucking what do they call those the big crossbow things?
Ballista?
But yeah, and if they had a fussed Rodor'd instead of that, you'd have been in Skyrim.
Yeah.
But yeah, they kind of have that, like the dragons somehow redeemed, like the nobility in humans came from dragons, which is another kind of like a bullshit concept in my mind. But you know what? It's fantasy. Who cares?
Yeah.
Sure. All things good in humanity came from outside sources. Why not? Why not?
Well, I was wondering about the lore of the dragons in this universe because there's some shit going on here. Like dragons can speak English.
Sure.
So I was thinking up until
dragons gave humans the English language, boy.
They speak a form of English. So at some point I was thinking, okay, well maybe the dragons mixed with the humans enough to where they picked up the language. It seems almost like we may have gotten our language from the dragons potentially.
Well, except for Sean Connery tries to pronounce his name, and I think you're going to get a whole bunch of Dovahkiin type growls and grunts and all that, and then he had an arm attack. So we never get to, but
You also, like, humans have multiple languages, right? So, like,
no, that's true.
Dragons might just be speaking both basic and also dragon. And then they pass it on to us. More likely, I think, they learned our language because they had to look over us or watch over us, rather.
That's a really cool science fiction idea. Like, if dragons were essentially the humans in the role and we're like the dogs, and we were just kind of like these cute things that they started raising for shits and giggles. And
it's pretty close to that in this movie.
They modified us because, like, the more intelligent we were, the more charming they found us. And, like, eons pass, and they have these talking monkeys. And, oh, shit, what do? We better teach them how to behave and start wiping their own ass. Yeah. I mean, that's kind of, like, a neat concept.
And I'm confused also because the movie, I think, implies that dragons live forever in this universe. Or at least, at the very least, Aynan thinks that dragons live forever. Because when, you know, he's at the... We go to the climax of the movie. He gets shot in the heart. He pulls it out and he goes, oh, fuck, I'm immortal. I better save this dragon so I can stay immortal. Mm-hmm. He runs over to the dragon and he's like, no, I don't kill him. I want him alive and safe. Safe for all of eternity. So he, at the least, thinks that dragons live forever.
Yeah.
Where would he get that impression? I suppose.
His mother's dragon. But I guess that's the other thing is the queen mother... The dragon lore expert, almost all of her scenes and stuff and lines were cut. So I'm sure there's probably stuff where they explain like what all this means. But they don't. I don't know.
They don't explain the magic that links them until the very end.
But I feel like the concept of these linked identities where one person feels the pain of the other and they're like their sensories are. I feel like that's a well enough established fantasy concept that I've rolled with it. It seemed to bother you a lot more than me.
Well, it is. It's definitely a well-established concept, but usually the way that it works is whatever happens to one also happens to the other, not whatever happens to this one only happens to the other, because this guy gets shot straight through the heart with an arrow.
Right.
And the dragon falls from the sky, but he just pulls the arrow out and he's totally fine.
Sure.
So whatever happens to him seems to only happen to the dragon. Mm. But it doesn't work in reverse. Whatever happens to the dragon happens to both of them.
Well, he did,
it doesn't
though,
because
like, the dragon
consistent.
Injured his hand deliberately at one point so that Aynan would have to drop his crossbow or sword or whatever, dagger or whatever he's holding against Dina's throat. So I think it does. It's just you don't see the dragon's not intentionally hurting himself off. He should have been doing it more often. Like, he could have broke both of his legs at the beginning of combat.
But I don't understand why he can just pull an arrow out of his heart and be okay.
Mm. Well, also, does Aynan have to be mortally, like, is this like a Harry Potter Horcrux situation where, what if Draco just kills himself?
Mm-hmm.
Does that instantly kill Aynan, or is this Aynan now mortal?
I assume it would instantly kill him, because what happens at the end of this movie amounts to that.
Yeah, but he had already taken massive mortal damage. Like, he'd fallen for 5 stories, he'd gotten stabbed through, so, like, what if that...
Right.
His dragon heart...
I'm saying, it doesn't seem to be a two-way street here, completely parallel. It seems like there's something that affects the dragon when it happens to Aynan more than the other way around.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I don't know if that's intentional or just kind of... and whatever on the part of the filmmakers.
Because I guess, if at any time Draco could just have killed himself, I mean, there's an argument that he should have had Bowen just run him right through. But I guess the other thing is the dragon wanted to make sure humans was redeemed, and he needed some leader like Bowen that he could leave and trust.
He did need to change the heart of Bowen at that point, because it's amazing what it takes to change his heart. How little it took to change the heart of Aynan,
right?
Because it's hilarious to me that Aynan goes into that cave with his heart pierced, and the dragon gives him half the heart, and as he's being fucking carted out on his what would have been his deathbed if not for this heart, he looks at the slaves and he's like, yeah, I think they should rebuild my fucking castle for me.
Yes.
Like, he has not even begun to recover yet, and he's already broken his oath.
Yeah, and that's the thing. I thought that's another thing they misplayed. Like, Bowen's rage against the dragons, they should have made the boy less of an obvious rotter. Like, that should have been a big reveal at the end of the movie, was like, you know, when he's talking about the betrayal of the code, and he's like, I never believed in your fucking code. I wanted you to teach me how to fight, and this is how I used you.
Mm-hmm.
But we fucking knew that, because from the very beginning of the fucking movie, this boy Prince it's like he's acting like Prince Joffrey, and like Tyrion is trying to teach this kid, like, hey, a peaceful people and a prosperous kingdom. That's what you want. That's your goal. And this boy is like, okay, whatever. But he's acting like Joffrey. And then when Joffrey becomes king and starts raping and murdering and pillaging, Tyrion be like, you've betrayed my teachings. Like, dude, you're just fucking obtuse and oblivious. And I felt like they could have done that. Yeah. Maybe they need 15 more minutes where they show like that. I don't know. I think they could have just played the boy as if he was an unironic disciple of Bowen. And then it's just a genuine betrayal that Bowen doesn't find out until the end of the movie.
No, I think you're right. A couple 10 more minutes on this movie in the beginning would go a long way toward selling that betrayal, that relationship between these two people. A lot of shit that just doesn't quite make the cut in this movie.
Yeah. I want to talk about some of the things that the movie struggles with because, well, let's talk praise. Special effects on the dragon, I thought, were of the era. It did seem like basically Jurassic Park era technology. So it's mm-hmm. not, I don't think it's going, it's, we're still a few years away from like the Matrix and Lord of the Rings and Phantom Menace. But we, like in this era, this is kind of like state of the art. But what's incredible is if I think Jurassic Park holds up, but one of the most visually impressive scenes in the original movie when I first saw it was when, you know, the character Grant sees the big Jurassic Park, like the big field of brontosaurus, apatosauruses, diplodocus. I don't know what they fucking call brontosauruses nowadays. The long necks, the veggiesauruses, mm-hmm. and everything's kind of like in harmony, is grandeur. I think that scene looks like shit. Because they're very obviously low poly dinosaurs with poorly textured skin and bright fucking sunlight. And that's one of the hardest things to do. Mm-hmm. But it does. And unfortunately, Draco in 90% of his movie is a Jurassic Park dinosaur with wings mm-hmm. that breathes fire that is in full fucking daylight. And it's a little rough. It's a little rough.
Yeah, a little rough, but not
but they didn't fuck it up.
Rough.
They didn't like someone.
No, I've seen worse. I've seen much, much worse.
People gave a shit. The people that were animating Draco and by and large did a good job. What's our opinion about the wrinkle in this movie seems to be that dragons only breathe fire through their nose.
Okay.
Like,
I mean, if you got two glands that kind of combine chemically to create fire, which I'm not even sure that's how this dragon works.
Uh-huh.
But a good place to separate those things is
left and right
within
nostril.
Two nostrils. Yeah,
that's true. That's
I feel
true.
Like that's actually just sort of a natural evolution.
So you're
thing.
Taking Rain of Fire dragon physics into Dragonheart. Okay.
Yeah. How else would it work?
Because I'm thinking like, unless dragons evolved like a separate nasal and mouth passages. Of course, a lot of scientists would say that'd actually be good evolution because the only reason we fucking choke was to try to pass the life-saving air through the same tube as we pass the life-giving water and food.
Now add fire to that.
Yeah.
What if you shot fire through your throat?
Yeah, like who the fuck merges on the lane going to the lungs and the stomach, man? Separate those tubes. But yeah, maybe dragons are ahead of, obviously ahead of humans on evolutionary scale. That's how evolution works.
And yet we kick their ass.
You have endpoints. Evolution's working towards ever-advancing endpoints. And no, that's not. Go back to school.
It's true. Eventually, we'll all become dragons.
So the almost everything else is pretty lackluster.
Like
the
Dennis Quaid's accent.
The Dennis Quaid's accent.
Which is not an accent so much as it is an affected voice.
Yes.
Like he seems to just put about two dump trucks worth of gravel into his voice, but only in certain scenes.
He sounds like Fozzie the Bear doing Batman.
How do I know I can trust you?
I give you my work.
The word of a dragon. It's worthless.
Waka waka.
I mean, it's
really
real weird.
Bad.
Yeah, and it feels like it's not. It would be something that would strain your throat if you do it for very long.
Oh, for sure. But he's not even trying to reproduce an English accent, as best I can tell.
I think so. This is where this thing gets kind of costinarian. Is that I do think there's times where he at the beginning of the scene thinks, oh, right. I've got a sword. I'm in mail. I should be doing some kind mm-hmm. of Shakespeare in the Park. And he starts like doing some of those British vowel sounds. And then like three sentences in, he's just back to work and old code. And yeah. Where again, Liam Neeson crushes that shit.
I mean, it's not actually that hard to do a British accent, Mr. Quaid. All you have to do really to sell it is just change the way you say your R's.
Yeah?
And you're good.
Because I struggle with this. I have a hard time with the British accent.
Just change the way you say your R's.
How
just
do you change
Don't say R.
What do you say?
Just say like ah.
Ah?
Yeah, just roll, let that R just kind of drift away a little
Dragon-haw.
But man, he leans into the R's as much as he leans into the gravel. I don't know. I
motherfucking rolling his R's in here.
You could if you want to go north of Britain.
Oh, right.
Or north of England. I don't know. I hated basically everything about the casting of Dennis Quaid. From he doesn't strike me as this kind of knight. He doesn't do any kind of accent.
He's a Han Solo, not an Obi-Wan Kenobi.
Yes, I agree with that. Also, I just have like Dennis Quaid is the most generic milquetoast of 90s actors, in the same way that Kevin Costner is milquetoast of 90s actors and Richard Gere. They're in my mind,
hot
100%
takes.
Interchangeable in any of their films. You almost wouldn't even notice because they look so generic, they sound so generic, they act so generic.
You could take those takes, put them in a reactor, and power a remote spacecraft with the heat coming
That's
off
what
of
I'm
those
here
takes.
For. That's what I'm here for, the hottest of takes.
But
am I wrong? Am I wrong? Don't they all just kind of have a similar face and affect? And
I would like you to challenge you to name three Richard Gere movies.
There's that one with the Julia Roberts.
Uh-huh, yeah, the Julia Roberts one.
That
yep.
other one with Julia Roberts, and that other one with Julia Roberts, right?
I don't think he was in that many movies with Julia Roberts.
Yeah, he did. That's all he does, the Julia Roberts movies.
Here's something.
Yeah.
Look at the first, any of the peasant battle scenes, actually, but the one in particular is, like, look at what is going on in the background. There are literally guys just running in circles, trying to find extras to fight with, not finding, oh, maybe I'll run and get the, oh, no, this guy, oh, okay, I fucking lost in tall weeds out there. And it's so funny because you combine that with, like, look at all the different implements they're using. Like, there's several times where, like, there people are simulating peasant life. And this guy's got this, like, carefully constructed medieval scythe that probably was signed off by some British fucking historian. And he is, like, waving in the air like he's trying to flag down a helicopter. There's people that have, like, okay, fine. Some peasants, all they got is 10-foot-long sharpened sticks. Fine. You can dehorse a horse. You can dehorse a knight with that kind of thing. But some of them have, like, forks at 45 degrees sharpened stick. I'm like, what the fuck are you going to do with that?
Two horses.
Roast weenies?
Two horses.
Two horses.
Yeah. Sit down right between a couple
you
of
know
charred
better
horses.
Piking one horse, you know, piking two, and wait until that 1,000 pounds of horse and metal hits that 45 degree wooden arc, man. It's going to support that weight like a champ. It's questionable. All of
the fighting is bad. Like even the main fighting, the stuff that is meant to be focused on, is laughable.
Look at King Einan's Hall, which I think they used a real dilapidated castle to film inside.
Okay,
but they rope everything that's unsightly, which is with the shittiest looking red velvet curtains that look like they're hung from enormous Walmart style curtain rods over vast sections of the set. Yeah. And they're not hung straight. It's just like they ran out of budget. The B unit just didn't give a fuck. I'm not sure what exactly happened, but it's kind of fucking hilarious. Building up to the most absurd set of all time, which I lovingly refer to as Bonehenge. They go to, I think, where King Arthur's castle, Camelot, should have been.
Yeah, Avalon, sure.
And they are on this thing, and there's this ring of towers that look exactly like circumcised penises. Mm-hmm. Of various sizes, and of course Arthur's is the biggest one, and it starts animating and talking.
Right.
Giving the code of the bone.
It is.
The bone code.
Truly ridiculous.
The old
looking.
Bone code, like, man, I feel like who submitted this sketch, who looked at it and said, yep, I'm gonna build a model for approval, who signed off on that model, and then who actually built it without anyone actually saying. Maybe they did. Maybe they said, like, are you sure you want to make this a big monument to the male phallus? And he's like, yeah, I need my pigs. I need my bone hinge. This movie falls apart without those facets, man. And they're like, all right. I mean, I thought I understood movie making Rob Cohen, but, you know, you directed XXX and the Fast and the Furious, so.
Oh, did he?
Yes, he did.
Wow.
Yes, he did. So there you go. You gave that man a gentle medieval fantasy hero's tale, and he fucking threw Vin Diesel into it.
The other thing that we forgot to talk about when we were talking about the tongue ride scene.
Yeah.
During the live watch, you questioned, when the hell did we lose Gilbert, the brother Gilbert? Because at some point...
Yeah. Brother Gilbert just
falls off
bored.
The map and then just shows back up in that pig
scene.
He
is behind a berm composing a sonnet late at night to how long this this battle between the knight and him is going to last. Then he disappears until he comes back at
here's
the pig
farm. Here's what's happening. Because I watched this again. So he, at the end of that scene, after he's composed his sonnet, or maybe he's like halfway through, he turns to the camera and he yawns.
And he falls asleep.
And he falls asleep.
And he misses everything. And of course,
and so the negotiation is still happening, right? And then like they come to this agreement, and apparently when they come to the agreement, the dragon and Bowen, they just take off and leave Gilbert there,
right?
Which I guess tracks
that
through the movie because Bowen doesn't want him there.
Yeah, Bowen's kind of like, just get the fuck away almost the entire. So
they just leave him sleeping in a field, and eventually he wakes up, and they do. Play that back in the movie. Like when he comes back to the pigs, he says, I saw him kill almost two dragons.
Yeah.
I didn't actually see the death blow, but I assume on that second one. So I feel like it tracks. It was just kind of funny that they leave that character asleep behind a rock in a field as the other characters go off and have a big adventure.
And then the other guy instantly comes back and vouches for, you know. But I guess the guy did kill a dragon. Like, I wish I'd seen how he'd killed the dragon, because it's hard for me to believe that an unarmed man, well, not an unarmed man, but a man with a sword and a shield can defeat a dragon. I've always had a problem with that in medieval literature. Yeah. It's like they just do, but like what amount of martial skill with a blade would allow you to take down like a Tyrannosaurus with fire and wings?
There's no way.
You give me the most divine, you give me a fucking lightsaber. I might be able to kill the T-Rex, but he's absolutely going to take me with him.
Yeah. I mean, the fact that this thing could shoot fire is...
Yes, that's
immediate death for any human who would challenge it.
Like, unless you've invented medieval asbestos.
Yeah.
And you can hang with that, then I don't... Yeah. And that's just a range threat. They've got that fucking club spike tail. They got, you know, dagger... Like I said, it's a T-Rex that breathes fire and flies. What are you going to do? With an alien spear tail. Before we close, we have frequently remarked about the importance of Dino De Laurentiis to fantasy film and science fiction
and this
film.
Super serious film fest, too. It's been...
Like, four out of the six movies, he's bankrolled. And I thought we'd finally gotten out of the De Laurentiis era. His daughter, Rafaela De Laurentiis, financed this fucking film.
Amazing.
And Kull the Conqueror and Dune. And I'm thinking that, like... Every nerd worth their salt, if to the extent they have a shrine to George Lucas and Gene Roddenberry and J.R.R. Tolkien, someone ought to light a candle to the De Laurentiis family.
Yeah.
Because these fuckers were plowing major bank into these fantasy films when nobody else was making them. And regardless of their success or failure, how cheesy or... They were just like, what I think is this De Laurentiis guy got a bunch of money... made a bunch of money making well-regarded, conventional, safe pictures that got nominated for Oscars and shit. And once he had his bankroll secure and he was unbustable, he's like, yeah, I want to start making sword sandals and titty flicks.
Yeah.
And his daughter's like, well, thanks for teaching me the ways. I don't know about the titties, but I too am an unironic fan of swords and sandals. I'm going to keep this thing going. It's incredible how much of 80s and 90s, 70s, 80s, 90s geek culture, especially on the fantasy front, comes from this one family. They're like what the Broccoli film is to British spies. These are to Conan the Barbarian and dragons. So give it up to the De Laurentiis family. Thank you for making these films. I wish you'd push back on the pigs harder. I wish you'd push for Liam Neeson a little bit harder, because then we'd probably have probably reviewed this as a commissioned podcast by now. Anything else, Jim?
No, that's it.
All right. See you for the next one.